Paul Kersey is Director of Labor Policy at the Mackinac Center for Public Policy, a free market think tank in Midland, Michigan. Thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me along.
I'm curious how you would cast sort of or describe the world in which the unions and the auto manufacturers are operating today. We have right-to-work states in the South where unions can't get a toehold. How do you sort of assess what we're looking at in terms of a productive marketplace?
Well, I think Professor Lichtenstein actually had a pretty fair description of things. The pattern, I don't know if I'd say it's broken, but it's definitely being strained because the competitive pressures from the transplants are growing greater, and so you do have the private you do have the non-union sector that is setting a lot more of the pace in terms of wages, in terms of benefits, and doing very well in terms of market share over the longer term. So I think it's fair to say that the UAW has become less of an economic factor. Their ability to sort of dictate wage rates and to dictate conditions across the companies is being strained, and you see that in two ways. First of all, you see more of a distinction than you used to in terms of the contract you have with the three companies. They matter more because the competitive pressure is more. The other thing that you see is that the wage rates, especially for the second tier, are now down in the teens, which is much more reflective of industrial wages, manufacturing wages in general.
And if you were to focus specifically on Detroit, because, you know, Detroit is obviously such a national story, a national ground zero for so many of the issues facing the country today, how important is it that the UAW remains vital and active in unionizing workers, do you think, in Detroit?
Well, right now, I think that that what is really needed most in Detroit is new industry, new jobs, new corporations in the auto sector and in a wide range of sectors. The specific role of the UAW is to negotiate on behalf of workers. It cannot by itself create jobs. It cannot by itself expand wages. It can help workers out by providing capable representation and allowing workers a place to sort of rally around when it's appropriate. But what is really needed right now is an expansion of the overall economy that will drive up the demand for labor in and around the city and create new opportunities that way.
And how do you think these issues are playing out in the, I'm curious, in the national sort of political races that are going on right now, very anti-union tenor of the GOP and the presidential race? How will that play out in relationship to the auto industry?
Well, I think what you have is a recognition of how the market is actually working. Things happen in a market for a reason, and unions cannot ignore those reasons. What you're seeing in the auto industry in particular is that new competitors are coming in. They're not shortchanging their workers in terms of basic wages, but they are producing valuable products that Americans find desirable. They have located mainly in right-to-work states, but that's not the real reason why they're struggling down there in the right-to-work states. That's not the main reason why the UAW has struggled to bring in new workers. The main reason they've struggled to bring in workers is that they've lost the confidence of a lot of working men and women.
Let's go back to Nelson Lichtenstein, professor of history at the University of California, for a response to that. Has the UAW lost the confidence of working men and women?
Well, I would say this. Insofar as the union is weak and is unable to demonstrate that it can produce, good contracts and good wages and preserve, for example, health care or pensions, then, yeah, a worker in Tennessee or Kentucky will say, why should I join a union that can't really move the ball forward? And that's why the second-tier wage structure, which was an emergency stratagem, at the height of the crisis,
it's very controversial.
It's right. It's controversial and is destructive of the union's appeal to workers in Tennessee or in Kentucky. So let me say this: markets are politically constructed. They don't exist in a vacuum. And over the last century, the government and unions and businesses, for that matter, have structured and created markets, and then within those markets, supply and demand, et cetera, works. But they're politically constructed. One of the great political constructs of the 20th century was the idea that workers should have the right to form unions and bargain. That's been eroded. That's a pillar of one of the structures of the market, which has been sort of half, more than half destroyed. To make that real again, requires enormous effort. The UAW is trying to do that, but insofar as it can't do that, insofar as you get concession bargaining, and for example, there's no wage increase in this current contract, there is a bonus, but there's no wage increase. Well, then, yes, workers in Tennessee or in Kentucky will say, maybe I shouldn't stick my neck out because I could get fired or penalized by being a union organizer.
I'm going to have to hold you there because we need to take a quick station break. On Reporter's Notebook later on, women get the vote in Saudi Arabia, but how will they use it? We'll be right back with To The Point from PRI. I'm Sarah Terry, sitting in for Warren Olney today on To The Point. We're talking about the United Auto Workers Union and the state of Detroit. Nelson Lichtenstein, professor of history at the University of California, Santa Barbara. We were speaking with you just before the break. I wanted to revisit a comment you made about the idea that so many things are political constructs, that the idea that people could organize as unions to demand labor and workplace rights was a political construct.
Mm-hmm.
I'm curious how you see what kind of landscape do we then have sort of becoming in front of us if that political construct is changing as it is with the autos, mm-hmm. the auto workers union in particular. What's the overall effect on a national landscape when that political construct changes?
Right. What's happened is that now wages are one of the bases upon which companies compete with each other. That hadn't been the case. So they're sometimes they don't go, they're cautious about it occasionally. They don't want to, but they do compete with this other on the basis of wages, and certainly on the basis of, for example, the real advantage of the non-union companies is that they have their pension schemes are inferior to that of the unionized sector, and also various kinds of working conditions are as well. But they compete on those bases. That had not been the case for the previous really half century of, you know. And well, if that's the case, then you have not exactly a kind of dramatic race to the bottom, but a kind of downward pressure throughout the industry. So in fact, today the auto workers, whether union or non-union, are no longer a pillar of the kind of solid middle class. And I would make just one little point here. It was a great tribute to the current UAW and to its membership that they made a big point of trying to raise the wages of the second-tier workers, indeed of workers who have not even been hired yet. And the veteran workers said, we'll take a wage freeze, we'll get a little bonus, we'll take a wage freeze in order to give more money to the people who are coming in, people we don't even know. I think that's...
And that's the two-tier that we're talking about, the established workers and the incoming workers.
That's the essential meaning of something called solidarity, which is a kind of a cultural and social concept which is quite alien in much of America today. It was more popular among the rank and file than even among the leadership that they wanted to do that. And I think that says something about...
What does it say? I'm curious.
Well, I think it says that when workers can make decide their own fate, they have a sense that they want the next generation to enjoy some of the same benefits they did. It's not I'm all right, Jack. It's not I'll take mine and to help help the rest of you. I think it says a lot, and I think that's something that the current political scene, which sort of emphasizes a kind of atomized individualism, I think that it misses that. And the UAW, and as I say, it was more popular among the rank and file than even the leadership, although leadership was in favor of it. And that speaks well of a kind of cultural and social and moral values of those workers.
Such an interesting point from Nelson Lichtenstein, professor of history at the University of California, Santa Barbara. Kristen Juchek, director of the Labor and Industry Group at the Center for Automotive Research. We spoke to you earlier. I'd like to come back to you for a response to what we've just heard from Nelson Lichtenstein about that sense of character and values that he was pointing out in the auto workers who were willing to take a freeze on their pay wages to make it sort of better for people they didn't even know yet. I don't think we're hearing those stories. I'm just so interested in the story of Detroit as a place where we get to choose and redefine what it is we value and who we are. It seems sort of like a ground zero for that.
Well, you know, one of the union's main goals, and in fact Bob King stated it was his number one goal in the set of negotiations, was to raise the wages for the second-tier workers. The second-tier wage structure was put in place in 2007 contract between the UAW and the automakers, so it predates the bankruptcies in 2009, and it was, you know, a little bit before the crisis, which they did see coming. In those negotiations, they also managed to take the retiree health care liability and put it into a union-managed voluntary employee benefit association or health care trust for retiree health care, and they took a big haircut on the amount of money that was the liability for retiree health care. And by doing that, lowered labor costs on average about $20 to $22 an hour. They were up in above $75 an hour in labor costs. That's not what workers make, but that's what the company was paying per hour for all their labor-related costs.
The impact of those things and those choices and those attitudes being reflected by workers, you know, as it relates directly to Detroit, you know, do you think we're seeing a period of time where sort of the contract, the civil contract, is being rewritten again?
Well, I think, you know, a lot of people came back to, we can't have these second-tier wages be so low that people can't afford to buy the product they're making. I mean, that goes back to the days of Henry Ford and why he paid $5 a day. So I think that culture is very much a part of Detroit, that they felt it was unfair for people to making $30,000 cars and not even making barely over $30,000 a year in their income. That was really reflected here, I believe. You know, there aren't very many second-tier workers voting on this contract. There are just a few thousand across the industry, according, you know, of the 112,000 UAW members in the U.S., just a handful are the second-tier already. But they are the ones, you know, this contract will set the rules for how the new auto workers are hired, the new generation that will backfill the retirements and the attrition that take place over the next 4 years.
We're talking to Kristen Gichak, Director of the Labor and Industry Group at the Center for Automotive Research in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Paul Kersey, Director of Labor Policy at the Mackinac Center for Public Policy. I'm curious what your thoughts are on what we've heard sort of laid out by Nelson Lichtenstein and addressed also by Kristen Gichak about this idea of a social compact, of like a new way of doing business that might be emerging.
Well, I think Professor Lichtenstein gets a couple of things backwards when he talks about markets being politically politically created, while and that is that trade, commerce, you know, even barter, those aren't necessarily the creatures strictly of law. I think they're the creatures of a larger culture, one that encourages people to trade and to swap and barter with each other on a system of high trust. At the same time, I think that the notion of solidarity may have actually been cheapened a little bit because it's become sort of a political and legal construct. The UAW's greatest glory days, as it were, the days when the notion of solidarity really were at its strongest, were when the UAW had to go on strike, and at one point they even had to take over a plant physically in order to gain recognition from the companies. But now under the National Labor Relations Act, once you have an election, recognition is guaranteed by the law. So and there are reasons why we did this way. I don't necessarily want to start this fight from square one, but one of the effects of that is I think that the notion of solidarity has sort of been cheapened a little bit. And another thing is that because of the typical union collective bargaining agreement in Michigan and the other non-right-to-work states, you have people who are covered by the contract are automatically treated as union members. They have to pay union dues or at least an agency fee in lieu of formal membership dues. And again, I think that sort of cheapens the notion of solidarity, where it becomes sort of you accept a financial transfer of dues funds that's made on your behalf without really being asked, do you believe in what this union is doing? Do you believe in what this organization is doing on your behalf? Do you really support their workplace and political agenda?
Paul Kersey is with is director of labor policy at the Mackinac Center for Public Policy. I've got one more guest to bring into the conversation today. Andrew Zago is an architect and native of Detroit. He's based in Detroit and Los Angeles. He's designer of the Museum of Contemporary Art Detroit, and he's currently working on a project for the Museum of Modern Art in New York, reexamining the dream of home ownership in a time of widespread foreclosure. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me on, Sarah.
The bulk of the show, obviously, has been talking about the UAW, the changing nature of it, and the relationships between the UAW and the auto industry. But as we noted at the top of the show, the story of the auto industry and the UAW is the story of Detroit in so many ways. And I'm curious, as an architect and a native of Detroit, what you see happening there now, like what's changing? Different conversations are happening, different relationships are being built. Is it affecting Detroit itself?
I think it is, and I certainly can't speak to some of the labor issues that have been discussed other than to mention that I'm a former Teamster. I think of note is how these struggles that the auto industry and the labor unions have had, how they play out, I guess, on the ground in terms of the physical and economic and social consequences for the city of Detroit itself. And it's become something of a popular topic to show photographs of the ruins of Detroit and its sort of physical condition. But I think unless...
Which are quite dramatic. I mean, I realize there's sort of a whole industry of showing those photos, but it's startling to look at a city that had 2 million people and has gone down to 700,000 and is tearing down homes and has vacant lots and was our powerhouse city.
That's right. And in fact, 25% was lost just in the last... since the last census, so it is pretty dramatic, and yeah, those photographs they're sometimes called ruin porn. But I think what has to be said, if you visit the city, you realize you don't have to seek out those kinds of conditions to photograph. A shockingly large percentage of the city is very difficult, with the exception of a few small areas, to find blocks that don't have at least a handful of homes missing or a handful of homes burned or derelict. And in many areas, it's feral. I mean, there's the ring-necked pheasant, apparently, hadn't been seen in Detroit since the turn of the 19th century, and there's flocks of them back in the city. So the physical thing is quite shocking. It's fascinating, obviously not in very nice ways, because there's very real human stories behind all of those photographs, but it is important to understand, in the range of possible outcomes and possible futures for cities, that is one, and it's not the only city that has those kinds of problems. But I think the part of the fascination is that, of course, Detroit was so important. I was seeing an article from 1929 called Detroit City of the Future, and it's a kind of breathless and slightly horrified description of the city by a visitor, and it would be as if they were discussing, say, Beijing a few years ago.
Wow.
Everything's on the move, everything is cranes and skyscrapers, they're buying artwork left and right with no taste. I mean, it was quite a fascinating thing. And I think what happened is, and this does relate to the auto industry, is that the city embraced, it's not just a decline of manufacturing in general, long before that, it embraced and reshaped itself around one single very large industry that very quickly was not something that would fit or work in a city.
Well, that in one century sort of kind of grew and declined, from Henry Ford and the production line to this incredible falling apart of the industry.
Well, that's right. And even in its glory days, parts that are now Detroit that were at the outskirts is increasingly where the automobile factories would have to go, because they were so big. And so the movement of it no longer being, as they say, city work, happened, very quickly after the automobile industry started. They had their second big boom during the Second World War, where it was called the arsenal of democracy. And certainly in terms of its architecture and its urbanism, you can look at the late 1920s and then the period, immediately after World War II into the 1960s, where you saw a real flowering of some very significant works of architecture and larger scale urban projects happening in the city. Now it's a very different situation now. Those kinds of things aren't on the table anymore.
Let me ask you a question as, sure. As an architect and somebody who knows the city obviously so well and its history. You referred to the photographs of ruins as, you know, sort of that ruin porn, that kind of a voyeurism at looking, yes, at the destruction of Detroit. If you were making photographs, what are the pictures that you would show us today of Detroit?
With the exception of my own projects, I suppose.
What do you want us to see? I mean, what are we not seeing in the concentration on those destroyed buildings? What hope is there in Detroit?
Things that are very difficult to photograph. I think things have gone into two different scales. I think starting with the Dennis Archer administration, who took over after the long-serving Mayor Coleman Young, he had a very much a pro-business, pro-development model that he brought to the city. And in parts it was successful. In the downtown, there was a development of bringing the two new stadiums to the city, bringing in the CompuWare business and building their headquarters there. It was really this model, though, that a silver bullet was going to save Detroit, that it needed, again, a large top-down kind of employer or business or entertainment venue to save it. It's been, I suppose, reasonably successful, but typically sterile and almost without exception, without architectural merit. You have at the other end something very interesting. You have, I think there's always been amazingly resilient and creative people living in the city of Detroit, but there's been this incredible influx of young people moving into the city or young people who are rediscovering a place in the city. And you suddenly find small little abandoned storefronts becoming coffee shops and restaurants. And I was there speaking to someone in a new coffee shop this weekend, and he introduces me to a fellow who had just moved in from Portland, Oregon, and is now making sort of artisanal cured meats in another storefront down the street.
Right.
And so there is this incredible sort of grassroots creativity. Something, however, it never kind of brings about, it can never cohere into significant urbanism, and the top-down models tend to be too sterile. I think what Detroit really needs and where its future is to find the kind of middle ground, projects that are real and true to Detroit, warts and all, but at the same time can rise above simply the most minute scale of grassroots efforts. And I think we're starting to see some of that.
We're talking to Andrew Zago, an architect and native of Detroit. I'd like to pose the same question to our other two guests before we finish the show today. Paul Kersey, Director of Labor Policy at the Mackinac Center for Public Policy. The question I asked Andrew Zago was, what are the pictures you would show us of Detroit if you were taking the photographs today to tell us the story of the city?
Well, I'd probably start off with my neighborhood up in the northwest corner where I grew up, and the area up there is not completely abandoned like you see some of the other areas, but you can see the sort of the early stages of the decay as families move out, as jobs become harder to find, as education quality education becomes harder to find. There's really basic problems that are plaguing Detroit, and the basic failure of government to focus on its core competencies. The education system in Detroit, you spend $14,000 per student, but in one case they had math tests that came back that were scarcely higher than random guessing would have gotten. And that scares off families. It scares off entrepreneurs. You get a population that is harder to employ, and especially harder to employ at any jobs that require high skills.
I'm going to have to stop you there because we really are almost out of time, and I want to let Kristen Jicek also have the opportunity to tell us what pictures she would take of Detroit.
Hi, are you there?
I'm here. Go right ahead.
Well, you know, I think when you go to the Chrysler Super Bowl commercial, really played into what's really going to bring back Detroit is its people. And, you know, it showed a little bit of the ruin porn that we've heard about here. But it really was talking about the spirit of people and what type of, you know, a working class city this really is and how we're going to rebuild from that. I think, you know, it's...
If you can pick up the handset, it's going to be easier for us to hear you, Kristen.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
Go right ahead. Okay. Kristen, there you are. Okay, if you can just wrap it up for us, what those pictures would be.
Well, I think the pictures would be of people,
okay.
And the people who would rebuild the city from the working class of Detroit, and that's how we're going to get the city turned around.
Okay.
We wouldn't have had an economy turned around. Our economy would have been devastated like those buildings if it were not for the rescue that the Obama administration did for this industry.
We got to end it there today, but thank you so much to all of our guests for joining the show. Christian Gichak from the Labor and Industry Group at the Center for Automotive Research, Paul Kersey from the Mackinac Center for Public Policy. We were joined earlier by Nelson Lichtenstein, professor of history at the University of California, and Andrew Zago, architect and native of Detroit.